This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello and welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season and festival season podcast from Vanity Fair.
I am delighted and proud to introduce him as Academy Award winner.
And the Oscar goes to...
And the Oscar goes to...
The winner, it's a tie.
And any little girl who's practicing their speech on the telly, you never know.
Mom, I just want an Oscar.
I am Katie Rich. I am here in North America. I'm here with Richard Lawson in Venice.
Hello. Buonanotte. Buonasera? I don't know.
With David Canfield somewhere on the road between Telluride and Los Angeles, I think.
Flagstaff, Arizona. Hello.
And with Rebecca Ford safely back home in Los Angeles, air travel for the win, I guess.
Hi.
Venice is still ongoing. Telluride has just wrapped up. The Toronto Film Festival is around the corner. I'll be heading to Toronto tomorrow. There are so many movies to talk about. It's hard to know where to begin, except I guess, Richard, you still being on the ground at a film festival that's still ongoing. Venice is kind of the typical 10-day schedule, unlike Telluride, which is a real quick in and out. How's the vibes, Richard? How's Venice?
The vibes are good. You know, obviously we don't have a lot of like big American stars here, unlike last year, which had, you know, Timothy Chalamet and then the Don't Worry Darling stuff. And that was like a very like all eyes from the like, gossip publications were on Venice. And this year it's just kind of film.
Jacob Elordi is very tall, though. So he is big in one sense of the word.
He is quite tall. I was going to say, the Priscilla premiere was on Monday night here. And you could hear on the Lido, the island where the movie screen. I was not looking at the red carpet because I was going to something else, but I was outside and all of a sudden a scream erupted and I was like, oh, Jacob Elordi definitely just arrived. I guess Euphoria or whatever else has made an impression here in Italy. But that, you know, that was a big screening. It went over very well. Priscilla Presley was there. There was a party on a private hotel island afterward where you had to take these motorboats to. And that felt sort of like the glam that had been otherwise missing this year. But either way, the lack of glam doesn't mean that there weren't exciting things. The movies, a lot of them have been good.
Well, let's start with Priscilla, though, because I think that's one, you know, without revealing too much, but what we hear, like we had heard kind of a lot of mixed things about it ahead of time. And I think we were all in some ways bracing for disappointment. And then, Richard, you were like, wait, this movie's great. And you were not alone in that.
Yeah, there had just been these sort of whispers that it wasn't good. And it was sort of like a really off movie for Sofia Coppola. Maybe it was good that I went in with sort of managed expectations, but I was really impressed. I mean, I think that the big question of the movie, I mean, especially, you know, we talked about Priscilla's book, Elvis and Me, on this podcast, is how is this movie going to handle the, you know, harder facts of how Priscilla and Elvis got together? She was 14 years old. He was 24. He kind of kept her sort of locked up in Graceland while he was away. Like, it's an intense story. And I think that Coppola manages to address that stuff without too much editorializing. It's kind of more in the audience's, hands to assess it, but also honor the fact that Priscilla, you know, does still speak lovingly of that time and of her former husband. And I think she finds that balance, you know, in her gentle, artful way. I mean, this is a more straightforward aesthetically film than some of her other past work. It's not as, you know, dreamy as Marie Antoinette or whatever else, but I think she conveys this feeling of a really young woman having a very strange coming of age in a lonely situation while still kind of caught up in this fantasy of, you know, a rock star came and whisked me away to this whole new life. And Kaylee Spenny, who plays Priscilla, communicates that well. And I think Elordi is really great as Elvis. You know, it's a much more interior performance because it's not about Elvis on stage like it was for Austin Butler in Baz Luhrmann's film. We just mostly see him when he's back home and being loving or not. And I think he does a great job.
It's really exciting the way that people are saying kind of blatantly this is her best film since Lost in Translation. And that film was such a breakthrough for her that when you're trying to predict like what an award season trajectory will be or how we talk about it, I don't think they're a fair comparison. But it does feel like she's back in the conversation in a way that she hasn't been, even with like really strong films like The Beguiled or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I would say best since Lost in Translation. You know, I really like The Beguiled, for example. But I think what this movie does is it's really speaking to Coppola's films like Lost in Translation, like Virgin Suicides and Marie Antoinette, that sort of, you know, young women a bit lost in this luxurious setting, but not really sure what to do with themselves. Like it feels of a piece with Coppola's work in a way that, you know, maybe On the Rocks didn't or even The Beguiled didn't. So I think you're seeing that kind of reaction, especially from people who are really devoted Coppola fans, that this feels like the next kind of chapter in whatever treatise on, you know, American or I guess just womanhood in general that she's been making since the start of her career.
Yeah. Does that feel like the hit of Venice thus far, or is that just recency bias speaking?
Yeah, I think that one definitely played near universally well. But I don't know. I think giving it competition would be Poor Things, the Yorgos Lanthimos film with Emma Stone. Another sort of coming-of-age movie, actually, but in a very, very different way. I was, you know, that's another one where I went in not sure what I was going to think about it because the trailer had given me some pause. But I really liked it. Emma Stone's incredible in it. And everyone else, or most people here, seem to agree.
So that was one of the ones that was doing the somewhat rare this year, Telluride and Venice combo, right? So David and Rebecca, you guys are hearing people talking about Poor Things and Telluride as well.
Yeah, I think it's a huge success. I think Venice was the perfect place to premiere that movie, and then it gave it sort of the momentum that everyone on the ground at Telluride was already talking about it by the time Yorgos made his nearly impossible flight from Venice to Telluride in time. So I wondered how that film was going to do, honestly, because Yorgos is so unique and you have to really just go with what he is presenting to you and not try to be logical about it. And I thought it would be more polarizing than it was, even though I really enjoyed it. But I am really impressed. It was like a huge success, I think, in its debut.
It was one movie where Rebecca and I had seen it before, and so we were really unsure of what the reception would be. And I really liked it too. I'm a little bit more mixed on it. I just think maybe it's a little bit long and hits its points quite frequently. But she's really incredible. And one thing that became clear near the end of Telluride was Searchlight had the two most acclaimed films at either festival over the weekend. Because it's pretty clear that they knew what they had with these two, having Poor Things launch in Venice and All of Us Strangers, which is their other one, premiering in Telluride. And just based on the numbers on Metacritic and Rotten Tomatoes, it's pretty far and away those are the two that have run away with at least that stamp of approval. And that's pretty rare for a studio to just kind of have that, especially when they only have two movies competing in that space. So it was definitely something that started getting talked about a lot, and you could feel the glee with that studio. They had a party in Telluride that Rebecca and I did not get into because it was at capacity.
Which does not happen a lot in Telluride. There are not usually lines to get into things.
And Emma Stone was in Telluride, right? Obviously, she's on strike. She's not walking the red carpet for Poor Things, but Yorgos was there getting some kind of tribute. So there was a level of celebrity support, even if it wasn't super visible.
She was like the Telluride ghost. Like, I saw her the first day and then never again, but she was definitely there. She paid her own way.
I was interviewing Saverio Costanzo, who's an Italian filmmaker who also had a film that went from Venice to Telluride. And I didn't see her, speaking to your ghost theory, Rebecca, but at one point he went, Emma Stone. And I was like, what? He said, that's Emma Stone. And I looked and there was no Emma Stone. But apparently she was there.
Is that part of the plot of Poor Things?
I actually think this is the plot of All of Us Strangers, but TBD.
Yeah, All of Us Strangers, I mean, you were talking about Metacritic scores. It has a 98 on Metacritic, tied by The Zone of Interest, which, did The Zone of Interest play at Telluride, or is it only...
Yes, it did, and I went to a screening there that... those are actually the two movies where I don't know how you define played well, because it's sort of like they end and you can sense people stunned into silence a little bit. Mm. I didn't see All of Us Strangers at Telluride because I'd already seen it, but the Zone of Interest screening, it was pretty remarkable, the spell that had been cast in that theater when, because it ends on a long black screen and it was just kind of haunting. Intentionally.
Yeah, I want to get to the Sandra Hüller moment of Telluride with that and Anatomy of a Fall. But with the 98 score on All of the Strangers, Richard, you might be the two that keeps it away from 100 with your review. Although your review was not especially negative at all. But it is interesting. Like, there, it is becoming kind of the like consensus, like, you will weep at this movie. And it might be a situation where moderating expectations is a good idea. Because I think when people are told, like, you haven't seen this movie, but it's going to ruin your life. Maybe a moderating influence like your review, Richard, is helpful. But you did like the movie a lot, I think.
I did like the movie, but I went in thinking I was going to weep, and I didn't. And because I had friends who had texted me being like, oh, my God, bring tissues to the screening, you know, and I left dry-eyed. I don't think that's necessarily a failure on the movie's part, you know. I just reacted to it in a more sort of intellectual way than an emotional way, which, you know, that's okay. Like, I think it has really interesting, very grim, kind of despairing ideas about gay life particularly. And it's not that I don't relate to them in some ways. I don't relate to everything that I think the character or maybe even Andrew Hay is going through in the movie, but it's really strong. And I know people, you know, here in Venice who had gotten to see it early, there was a lot of conversation about it here even, even though it wasn't playing here. I think it would be really interesting to see how that movie fares. I mean, you know, it's similar to Poor Things in one way, which is like, there's like sex in it. You know, we're kind of at this moment now where like with Passages and All of Us Strangers and Poor Things, it's like, I feel like that aspect of life has not been really sort of in the conversation of awards movies, you know.
Because you get banned from TikTok if you express support for sex in movies, unfortunately.
Right, exactly. So I don't know. I think that with All of Us Strangers and Poor Things, these two Searchlight movies that played very well at their respective festivals, like, are these Academy friendly? You know, they're certainly Critics Awards friendly, top 10 list friendly, but... Academy, I wonder about. I think the thing helping Poor Things, and maybe why it got a sort of even better than expected reaction from both festivals, is that toward the end and throughout, but really at the end, there is sentiment in there in a way that there's not in a lot of Lanthimos' other work, you know? And I think you leave the theater feeling a kind of, I think I said in my review, sort of that like sense of accomplishment of a long journey, you know, completing and then you're home, you know? And I think that really helps it. And obviously there is a ton of sentiment in All of Us Strangers. So maybe that's the kind of special thing that puts these two really respected filmmakers over the line. I mean, obviously, Lanthimos had success with The Favorite, but I think that also had some sort of emotionality to it, too.
It's interesting because I had a similar experience with All of Us Strangers to you, Richard, where literally I was sitting down in the theater in Telluride and someone came up to me and said, "Get ready to cry." And I was like, uh-oh, like, that's not...
I'll cry if I want to cry.
You don't tell me when to cry. No, but the hype was... I saw a later screening at Telluride, so the hype was already pretty high for me, and I liked the film a lot, and I especially loved the performances, but I wasn't as emotionally connected as the three people next to me who were bawling their eyes out by the end, you know? And that kind of takes you out of your experience, because you're like, why am I not crying like those people? So I think, I'm curious to see how it plays when more and more people see it. Because I think it's a really well done film. But yeah, I don't know. That was a perfect example of how hype can really really affect your experience.
So I was the only one who was heaving.
No. I'll get my chance someday. Well, I was going to suggest, though, as mad as I am that All of the Strangers isn't at TIFF because I'm dying to see it, I wonder if that hype level, if managing that is something that that film and some of the other ones that are not going to TIFF, where you get a huge audience in front of you, you know, it'll be at New York Film Festival in about a month, which was, I think, a smaller crowd. I wonder if that's part of the math there, where you get a lot of attention on a smaller scale, but then you don't immediately platform up to something huge like TIFF.
Yeah, I mean, we should talk about the third movie that I think we heard a ton about in Telluride, which was Anatomy of a Fall. Mm-hmm. And that that is going to Toronto. And I think that that says a lot about both the confidence that that campaign is probably feeling right now. I mean, it was just playing like gangbusters in Telluride, in a way that slightly reminded me of Parasite making those fall festival stops after its Cannes premiere.
Well, it's just neon. It's like the blueprint, right?
But also just the word of mouth. I mean, I remember being in Toronto at that Parasite year, and it was the film that everybody was talking about. Yeah. And certainly, you know, well, at the neon party, most obviously, but also just on the street and we're on the gondolas. Like, it was the movie that if I asked people what they were loving, it was that and Strangers and Poor Things that I heard about the most. And I think of those three, you know, Poor Things has this, you know, Lanthimos comic element that's really strong. From the people I talk to, I think Strangers does hit an emotional chord for a lot of people. And then I think Anatomy of a Fall is, it's kind of a thriller. And it has this really strong, suspenseful element that I think carries it in a way that gives it an extra advantage because it's going to play really well with audiences, and it already has. So I'm really curious to see how that momentum continues in Toronto.
Well, there was the Hollywood Reporter had a cover last week heading into Telluride with Sandra Hüller, the star of Anatomy of a Fall and Zone of Interest, on the cover, and said, like, Sandra Hüller, actress of the year, ? And Neon tweeted, like, no question mark, she just is the actress, which was kind of impressive negging on their part. But it sure feels, I mean, for, you know, Emma Stone getting incredible amount of praise for Poor Things, she won an Oscar not that long ago. I think she will be part of the conversation. But Sandra Hüller just feels like on a rocket ship right now.
Yeah, yeah, and she was in Telluride. Like, she is able to attend these festivals, which I think really helps her because, you know, she's not as familiar of a face to American audiences. So I think that's a huge advantage she has to be able to do interviews and show up and really get herself out there.
And a lot of the movies in English. Yeah.
But it's also enough in French where it can qualify for international feature, which is a nice little combo for that movie.
I wonder if they did that math, like when they were making it.
I think they do.
One more line in French. One more line.
Well, someone said it 51% to me, and I don't remember who said it or how accurate that is, but I'm throwing it out there. As, if it is 51%, I have to believe that they knew to an extent.
But we don't know it's France's submission yet, right? They haven't made... I know, like, Japan chose the Wim Wenders movie recently, so those selections are starting to come in for international feature.
Correct, we do not know yet.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the Reviews Director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, Jay Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Okay, well, I want to stick with the Best Actress race for a Telluride premiere, because I think Nyad, from what you guys were saying, was like the other big like audience pleaser of Telluride. And talking about that like emotion where you get to the end of something and feel like you've been on a journey, like sports movie format is kind of hard to beat that. And it sounds like Nyad really gets there.
Yeah, it's one of those, I moderated one of the Q&As, and you could just feel in the audience because it is so uplifting. And, you know, a lot of the films that Telluride are not exactly uplifting, they're tearjerkers, but this one really is a very audience-friendly film, and Annette Bening and Jodie Foster are beloved, especially by the filmmaking community, so I think everyone's really excited to see these performances. It has a lot of the ingredients to be really successful, I think, this season for sure. And they brought along Bonnie, who is the Jodie Foster character, like, who, you know, I think I've said this before, my theory of like bringing in subjects and outsiders, especially athletes, like Hollywood just loves seeing those people and talking to them. And she's very refreshing because she's just like not a part of the Hollywood machine. So she
because
just,
Diana Nyad, the real one, is in SAG.
She's
but Bonnie
in SAG,
is not.
So she couldn't come. Yeah. So Bonnie was there, and I think that's a very charming aspect to have, you know, the real people there, because you just can all sort of bask in their greatness in person. So
yeah,
they did a lot right, I think, with their debut.
It is worth noting that also Diana Knight appears to be in a bit of hot water over past statements and things of that nature, which we don't need to get into at this point too in depth on the podcast. But it was a talking point in Telluride, I will say. The LA Times had a really good piece kind of running down the situation that the film finds itself in vis-a-vis Diana Knight, who was somewhat involved in the movie and worked with Annette Bening just in training and things like that.
But it's mostly about her inflating her record, right? Like, that's the crux of the accusations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the movie presents a pretty, you know, flawed portrait of her. So I don't know that the movie's necessarily made a gigantic mistake on that part. However, I do think that depending on how this goes, it's worth watching. Mm-hmm. But that said, and I wrote about this a little bit over the weekend, I think this is a movie that's going to be underestimated. You know, just hearing about how it played with like literal cheering in the screening room. Netflix will have movies that are more critically acclaimed, like May December or Maestro, which we will, of course, get into. But this movie has a really rousing, crowd-pleasing quality that coupled with the narratives of Bening and Foster, and, you know, caveat, I do think campaigning will be an important part of this movie's trajectory. So we'll see how the strike impacts that. You know, I think it has something that is going to speak to a pretty large chunk of the Academy, and that has some really strong narratives to play off of. And they're both really fantastic in the movie. And, whatever people think of the rest of the movie or the brewing backlash around it, those elements I think are pretty undeniable.
Yeah, I wanted to jump to Maestro, speaking of biopics and Netflix and brewing controversy in various ways. You know, I had read your review of Maestro before the festival, Richard, so I was kind of like prepared for it. It felt to me like it flew a little under the radar at Venice, which surprises me because it is such a major movie that did get really good reviews. Am I reading that wrong? I was obviously not present in Venice.
No, you're not reading that wrong. It was weird. You know, you would see people at, you know, a screening the next day and say, what'd you think of Maestro? And they'd say, oh yeah, I liked it, you know, like, and that was kind of it, which does not mean anything for that movie's, you know, trajectory. I don't think.
No.
I think that it's really going to find more ardent support at New York Film Festival where it's playing. It's a very, you know, it's a very, about a very New York figure, even though he's from Boston. And yeah, I mean, I think that regardless of Maestro, you know, maybe getting a little bit, not overshadowed, but it was sort of sandwiched between two like movies that went over really well, you know, in Poor Things and Priscilla. I think that what everyone I've spoken to here said, you know, after the initial, I liked it, is that Carey Mulligan and Bradley Cooper are really great in it. And that was kind of my big takeaway. I appreciate a lot of the movie, its artistry. I think it has a little bit of an issue deciding how it wants to tell the story and really what story it wants to tell versus, you know, a career biopic of Bernstein or a love story of a sort with him and Felicia Montalegre. But regardless of that, the performances, I think, are really like big and theatrical in a great way and really exciting. And I don't think they will have any trouble, staying in the awards conversation all the way till the actual show, the Oscars.
Is it Bradley Cooper versus Barry Keoghan? And we're going to set Cillian Murphy and Oppenheimer aside and focus on the new shiny stuff. Because certainly in terms of best actor, it seemed like Barry Keoghan and Saltburn was really the competition for attention to Bradley Cooper.
Hmm. Yeah. Should we talk about Saltburn first?
I know that you opened up a can of worms there, Katie.
I don't know which direction to take.
There's so many places to go with
I had an involuntary to the Rebecca, why don't you, you break that down?
The first day, David and I go this very nice brunch before anyone's seen any movies at Telluride. And we kind of poll people about what they're most excited or curious about. And Saltburn, I think, won that race
by far,
very clearly, because everyone was just like really curious to see this movie. And then,
well, thanks for our first look too. Those images we ran.
It was obviously all because of our
yes, obviously.
and then as the festival went on, you know, the film was met with a lot of mixed reactions, but there was tons of debate. Anywhere you were in line, on a gondola, you were. This is the movie people were bringing up to debate about how they felt about it. And to me, that's really exciting. I had seen this movie a little early, and I knew it would be divisive. I think the reviews are sort of almost some of them, not Richard's, but some of them sort of gleefully critical, but that's a whole nother thing we can get into later. But, you know, its reviews are very mixed to negative. So I'm really curious. Like, I think this is going to be a really interesting study about how it does throughout the season. I think Barry Keoghan is undeniable in that role, and Rosamund Pike is so good. And you just hope these performances don't get lost among the debate. So I don't know. It's such a strange rollout. I don't know what's going to happen to that movie.
To be really blunt about it, it was the worst reviewed world premiere out of Telluride. And that's a pretty notable fact of the matter.
That surprises me so, because I just feel like I saw much more of that, even on Twitter, like much more of that debate and like eagerness to engage with it more than just negativity.
Well, I mean, this is a really strong Telluride. I mean, that's the other side of that, is a lot of the films were very, very well received. I think that the difference between a movie like that and, say, a movie like Naiad, which isn't going to get, you know, glowing reviews either, is I don't know that, you know, I was thinking about Saltburn in comparison to Poor Things, which is, you know, Poor Things is really going to need that level of support, whereas Saltburn, it's a really weird movie. It's a very, you know, depending on your perspective, I think for a lot of Academy members, very risque movie. And I think it's in a tough spot awards wise. You know, I saw it on opening night. I had a great time at that screening. And I did leave it feeling a little bit like, you know, I just don't know if it's going to have the juice without that kind of fuel. You know, it will have a strong audience response for sure. And I think Barry Keoghan is amazing in the movie, really amazing. And I hope he is in that conversation. But I wrote a piece over the weekend about just the amount of Best Actor contenders that emerged, you know, that first night alone in Telluride, because you had, in addition to Keoghan, you had Colman Domingo, who I think is really wonderful in a movie that will be more easily embraced in Rustin. Paul Giamatti, we really probably should talk about The Holdovers,
yes, for sure.
I think is a very tasty Oscar movie for that demographic. And I think Andrew Scott is really a strong competitor. That's definitely my, you know, desires filtering in a little bit. But, you know, the movie I would compare it to acclaim-wise, vibe-wise, is something like After Sun. And I think he will fill that slot in a way where I think the love for the movie is going to be stronger than the love for Saltburn.
I mean, the idea of being a polarizing movie that gets everybody talking and that takes you a long way, like, that is the Promising Young Woman path. And 2020 was an outlier Oscar year in many ways. But I think if we have these emotional movies that, you know, try to get you swept up in feeling, having something that kind of needles people might not be a bad route compared to the competition out there.
I do think one difference is that Promising Young Woman had a kind of a clear social bent to it that people could glom onto in that regard. And Saltburn it's really fun and maybe more surface level. You know, I think what Emerald Fennell accomplishes here is really impressive aesthetically, but it is a movie that I think is harder to sort of assert a level of, you know, say importance or weight, which is the tricky thing here.
And, you know, if it's just a fun fall thriller that makes some money, great. You know, I don't think it necessarily has to be awardsy. You know, I would vote for Rosamund Pike in a supporting actress thing, you know, maybe first round or something. Like,
absolutely. You know, she's so fun.
Barry obviously is really good too. Very revealing. you know, and Elordi's good. But I don't know. I think that movie might kind of get a little burdened by awards expectations in a way that, like, you know, maybe it should just kind of be a fall thriller. I don't know, but it'll be interesting to see. I think also my personal gripe with that movie, but maybe that kind of applies to why it was a little tepidly received at Telluride, is like, I really enjoyed it and then didn't like the ending. And if you leave the theater with that feeling in your head, it's like, oh, you know, like it kind of almost undoes everything that you saw for, you know, an hour and 40 minutes when the last five kind of don't work for you. And then you have
it's
to
like
kind
the opposite of the triumphant sports ending. Like it sends you out dampened as opposed to uplifted.
Right. Which could also, speaking of things that you might think are triumphant sports stories, but aren't, is Ferrari. Mm-hmm. Is like the Michael Mann movie that was here at Venice was like, I dumbly went in expecting like basically a Ford versus Ferrari prequel, which, you know, not my cup of tea necessarily, but like I thought it would be arousing. And there are like really bracing racing scenes, car racing scenes, but like two of them end in horrific tragedy. So it's just like, I don't know what that does to that movie's Oscar chances, even though there are good performances. But yeah, that ending at festivals in particular, you want to get people in some way soaring out of the theater or weeping out of the theater because of what, you know, whatever the last shot was almost, because that goes a long way.
Well, is that what The Holdovers has going for it? You were saying it kind of fits an Oscar-y demographic. And it's a movie that I think you guys all liked, too. Not that it's simple, but Alexander Payne, I guess, is not really like the triumphant saga person we think of. But it does sound like it's pretty appealing.
I really enjoyed it. I think it's because it is like classic. It feels very, you know, it's obviously harkening back to the 1970s filmmaking. And you're just enjoying like really classic filmmaking with really strong performances when a lot of what we're seeing is, as we're saying, you know, polarizing and weird and bold. And this is just like a really charming, well done movie that I never looked at my watch, was just like totally in the world he brought us. And, you know, when I think about the Academy audience, especially the more traditional, that is definitely going to appeal to them.
I really liked it too. It just plays really well. It's a great Toronto movie. I would definitely watch out for it for the Audience Award. It seems to be have its eye on that kind of path. And, you know, Alexander Payne's a director who usually is very embraced by the Academy. He was nominated for Best Director for Nebraska, even, which was a smaller movie that had a bit of a slower launch out of Cannes, I remember. I would be surprised if this isn't pretty strong player for him and for Focus Features. It's their main focus, as it were, this year. I think Giamatti is very much in a very densely packed Best Actor conversation, I think, but he's for sure a part of it. I think Divine Joy Randolph can go really far in supporting actress. That was my strongest like awards take out of the movie, in addition to just really enjoying it and appreciating that Alexander Payne was back in this mode. He really gives that character a lot of space, and he allows her to be funny and heartbreaking and more than what I was fearing in terms of, you know, what the stereotype of that character could be. And that's in large part to her performance, which is really commanding every time she's on screen. And it feels like the kind of breakout performance from an actor who suddenly you're seeing in a whole bunch of things that could really coalesce a lot of support.
She was so great in Dolomite Is My Name, which was a big TIFF breakout in 2019, I guess. And like it felt for that moment like she could really ride those coattails. So it feels kind of nicely full circle. I mean, it didn't premiere at TIFF, but it does feel like that is the movie that can build off of these festivals to a big audience moment by going to TIFF as opposed to some of these other ones.
Yep.
Well, Richard, we're talking about actors, and I feel like there's two films with almost identical titles. I'm not totally sure we're going to have in this best actor conversation, but I'm very interested in both Richard Linklater's Hitman and David Fincher's The Killer, which I think it sounds like he liked one of them significantly more than the other.
Yeah, it's funny that Linklater and Fincher are these two like huge American directors, you know, sort of from the same generation. Make very, very different movies. But, you know, them both having world premieres at Venice, like that feels like that's a big, big deal. And yet I think both movies, one for kind of good reasons and the other for slightly bad ones, neither of them feel that significant here. The Linklater is really cute. You know, Glenn Powell, it's based on a true story. He plays a kind of unassuming guy who is freelancing with the New Orleans Police Department to sort of help them entrap, in a way, people trying to hire a contract killer, but then through a twist of fate, he has to become the undercover guy pretending to be a hitman, and get sort of swept up into something because of that. So he gets to play all these.
I just rewatched The Departed, so that sounds all perfectly reasonable to me.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, Glenn Powell gets to play, you know, put on wigs and do funny accents in a kind of series of scenes, and but otherwise just really like hold the camera with his innate charisma, which is pretty significant as people who've seen him in various things know. So that's fun. It doesn't have a distributor, I don't think. So we'll see what ends up happening with that.
That will be at TIFF also. Yes. And sounds like maybe it could be a fun time.
Yeah, I think that there will be interest in seeing it because it was at Venice. It's probably going to get, you know, mostly favorable reviews here, I think. And then, yeah, Netflix has The Killer, which is the Michael Fassbender starring movie where he plays an unnamed assassin, much, much more high stakes than the people in the Linklater film. And there's some really great set pieces in that movie. There's a great fight scene that involves household implements and fists and guns. And it's just like, it's like really good Finchery technical filmmaking. And then the Tilda Swinton part of the movie is really great because she's great. But the whole thing didn't really hang together for me. I think its structure is sort of innately anticlimactic, the way the story is told. And I don't know, it feels like an odd choice for Fincher, kind of returning to his more gritty, dark roots after Mank, to make something that feels this small, you know, and it doesn't really announce itself with much vigor beyond, you know, a couple interesting set pieces. So we'll be curious to see what happens with that. It is getting a theatrical release before it drops on Netflix. But yeah, I think in the battle of the hitmen, I think Linklater wins. Although the big loser is probably Harmony Korine, who had a movie here called Aggro Drift that is shot entirely in infrared heat vision that I don't know anyone who stayed for the whole movie.
You've lost me, Richard.
Yeah, I don't know anyone who stayed for the whole movie. I'll say that.
Oh, man.
I think it's premiering at midnight at Toronto, which sounds like a real like opportunity for weird dreams or something.
That is also about a hitman. And that. So I think if we had to rank the hitmen, it would start with Aggro Drift, then Killer, and then Hitman himself.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
Well, Venice isn't usually an acquisition market, but there was actually news out of there for Ava DuVernay's Origin, which, Rebecca, you had the first look on, where she talked about making that movie independently very deliberately. And now she has a distributor, although a distributor who's not part of AMPTP. So presumably we'll be able to continue hearing about it through promotion. Tell us about Origin, Rebecca.
Yeah, so Ava made it very clear she wanted to make this independently. I read Cast, you know, it's Isabel Wilkerson's book that was a really, really big hit. And I was like, how is this adaptable? This seems impossible. But what, you know, what she did, what was very smart, is she made it about Isabel's own journey writing the book and doing the research and her own sort of personal challenges. You know, she had some loss in her own life that a loss, you know, within her family that happened around the same time. And that really holds the story together and features an incredible performance by Anjanou Ellis, which I think we're all really excited to see. So it's a very emotional film. I was bawling by the end of it. And I felt like it would get picked up by probably, you know, it was Neon who picked it up. I expected something like that, one of these specialty distributors to pick it up, because it's a really well done film. So it got announced that it's also going to Toronto. And I think it's building that momentum. And I think reviews should be out by the time this posts. But I think it has something to say. You know, a lot of Ava's films really dig into specific issues, and she does that well here, but also makes it a really personal story.
I'm very excited for Little Goldman MVP and personal friend, Anjanou Ellis. Not really personal friend, but one can hope. But she's so extraordinary.
It is funny in Origin that Anjanou Ellis, her husband is played by John Bernthal. So basically Venus and Serena's mom married their tennis coach.
Oh my God. I forgot all about him being in King Richard. Yeah, that's really exciting. And it's, I mean, Neon is so dominant in this conversation we're having right now, and with so many of these pickups, and I think they must know they're in a good position being kind of outside of the strike negotiations. I think this is the first time they'll have had so many like hardcore contenders in this way. It'll be a really interesting fall to watch how they play that out.
I guess we don't know it's going to be 2023 yet.
Yeah, that's also true.
But yeah, they have proven to be among the best at playing this game, this acquisition game, and knowing how to position these movies. But yeah, I'm very excited for it. When we had Ingenue on the show last month, 2 months ago, whenever right before the strike happened,
yeah,
she talked about just how hard she had to fight for this role and how much she believed she was the person to play it. And I'm excited to see what comes of that.
And it's her first lead role, right? Wasn't that something you talked to Ava about, Rebecca?
Yeah. And I mean, both her and John Bernthal, who is supporting, they're so just like full of talent. And why don't they lead every movie? Because you can't stop watching them. You know, they're so incredible. So, and Niecy Nash has a great role in it, which is also supporting. So there's a lot of strong performers in it for sure.
John Bernthal might be cleaning up Emmys for season one of The Bear, Golden Globes for season two of The Bear, and then Oscar nominations for Origin all at the same time. It's not complaining.
I'm just fine with that. Just give him giant movie roles as a lead after all that, please.
Yeah.
Before we wrap up the Telluride conversation, I just want to shout out to the many listeners that David and I got to meet on the ground there. I've never been approached so much as I was at this festival. And, you know, it's really cool to see. I should have known, because obviously Telluride is for film lovers, but it was just really cool to sort of talk to the people who listen to this out in the wild. So never be afraid to come up to us. I think it made the festival even more fun for me.
Out in the wild, complete with roaming bears.
Yeah.
the bears don't listen, as far as we know.
You all will love to hear that at Zone of Interest, I was next to someone who asked who I write for. I said I write for Vanity Fair. She said she was a huge listener of Little Gold Men, and then said that she listened to your book club episode on Zone of Interest and was very glad she did before seeing the movie.
And when you're like, why did you have to pick the one I wasn't on?
I did say that, and I got a little annoyed. No.
I had several gondoliers spit in my face and say, fuck off, Little Gold Men. They don't like it.
It's different in Venice.
Yeah. They're Sean Fennessy fans.
we have no beef with Sean Fennessy. Let's just be clear about that. And yeah, so Richard and David and I, along with Hilary Busis, frequent guests on the show, will all be in Toronto in a matter of days, seeing a good number of these titles. Also, if you are listening and you see us, please say hello. I'm looking forward to everything because I haven't seen anything yet. I really wanted to shout out American Fiction, which we ran a first look on that Chris Murphy wrote for us. It's Cord Jefferson's directorial debut. He won an Emmy for Watchmen. It stars Jeffrey Wright. It's an adaptation of a novel I haven't read, but it's like very like literary world satire that sounds incredibly sharp. So that's a huge one for me. There's so many titles that are all these other festivals that kind of feel like the Oscar-y ones. And TIFF has like a couple movies that we know are coming out, a lot of acquisitions that are, you know, from these actor directors that we don't know where they're going to be. So titles like American Fiction or The Boy and the Heron and Nick Skull Wins feel like they're looming really large for me right now. How about you guys?
There were a couple of movies in Telluride that Rebecca and I started hearing about a lot. One of them was called The Teacher's Lounge.
I got to see that early. It's really good.
I couldn't make time for it, and I'm really excited to check it out in Toronto. I sort of had it in my mind that I could do that because the Telluride schedule gets so crazy. You know, I'm really interested in Dumb Money. We also had a first look on that a while back from Anthony Bresnikan. It's got really good cast. It's a fun true story to unpack, and it seems like something that's right up Craig Gillespie's alley. Your mileage may vary on what that means, but I think it'll be a fun TIFF premiere. And the other movie I would definitely highlight that seems like it could be a TIFF breakout is Dream Scenario, starring Nicolas Cage. Ari Aster produced it, and it just sounds like kind of a wild ride. So we'll see how that one turns out.
How about you, Richard? You have to recover from your transatlantic flight first, but then what will you be ready for?
Yeah, I have a nice 12 hours in New York, and then there's some stuff that was at Telluride, like the Pain movie that I'm excited to see there. I'm not going to get to see Origin here, so I'll check it out in Toronto. In terms of new premieres, I think I said this last week, but I'm sort of excited to discover some things. I obviously have, like, there's Pain Hustlers. I'm curious about that. That sounds kind of grim and fun. But, like, I don't know. I have stuff on my schedule that's like, oh, Carrie Coon's in it. Sure. You know, or someone, you know, Michael Keaton directed it. Okay. You know, like,
right.
So I don't know. I mean, I think that the big question is, because a lot of the movies that we just spent the last, you know, 45 minutes talking about aren't going to be at Toronto for various reasons. And so what movies that are then get that much more of a chance to kind of shine? I think, depending on, I know how it's going to go. And then after Anatomy of a Fall plays there, it's like, well, Sandra Hüller is definitely getting an Oscar nomination. You know, like, I think that's the kind of fun thing to kind of keep an eye on. Zone of Interest is going to get a much bigger audience than it had in Cannes and in Telluride. So how does that go over? I'm kind of excited to see those narratives solidify as well as making those other hopefully interesting discoveries.
And Naiad and the Holdovers, too, are in that category.
Yeah, Naiad, I'm really, because that feels like the way you guys were just talking about Naiad, it's like, oh, so she's going to win.
Well, baseball thing for Naiad is that it's screening kind of late in the festival. It's not screening till Tuesday. And Holdovers, I think, premieres on Sunday. Like, often the movies that are coming from Telluride will have later slots in the festival. So I'm not going to get to see Naiad.
The women talking effect.
Yes, exactly. So if you notice, like, weirdly muted buzz on Naiad next weekend, that's because it hasn't played in Toronto yet. But, you know, I guess it'll start popping up in the middle of the week next week.
Yeah, and Women Talking was still... runner-up for the People's Choice Award, despite premiering very late there. And that, I think, was a big indicator of the fact that it actually could be an Oscar player, which some people didn't believe at that point.
What will we be smug about from this year's festival? Only time will tell.
I believe I have sent a text message to at least some of you that I think Bradley Cooper's going to win an acting Oscar. I maybe am feeling less secure about that after Venice, but we'll see.
Don't back down, Richard.
And you know, I say Naiad and I don't say Rustin, and I should definitely. They're both Netflix biopics that I think have similar appeal, and Colman Domingo will hopefully meet a lot of love there. And he's also receiving a tribute in Toronto, not for Rustin, which is a Netflix movie, and it is not mentioned on the TIFF tribute release form, but he's also there for an acquisition title called Sing Sing, which I don't know much about, although being a huge Colman Domingo fan, I'm sure he's fantastic in it. And it's a canny way for him to still get a bit of a bump in this race, because a lot of people can't do anything at all.
Sing Sing's about the prison theater program.
Yes, that's right. That's
at Sing Sing
right,
Prison.
Right.
And it's him, and I think a lot of the other people in the movie are actual either current or former inmates.
You're right.
Yeah, I have that on my schedule at the same time as Holdovers. So it's one of those classic film festival, like, how do I figure out how to square the circle?
Also, another Little Gold Men MVP, Vicky Creeps, is also getting a TIFF Tribute Award.
Yeah, she's in the Viggo Mortensen movie, The Dead Don't Hurt.
I keep calling it The Dead Don't Die.
I know.
I Googled it yesterday, and I was like, no, it's not Jim Jarmusch.
Well, it's because there's all these, you know, there's a handful of actors making directorial debuts, like Patricia Arquette and Anna Kendrick. But then Viggo Mortensen, like, he's got a track record. Like, Captain Fantastic went a long way. So, yeah, that's definitely one to keep an eye out for, too. Well, we'll be back next week talking about all of this. We'll have so much to dig into. Follow us at on Twitter and Instagram, VF Awards Insider. We have a live blog running from Venice and Telluride that will pivot to TIFF. So as you listen to this, you can scroll back through days and days of posts and details and who David spotted at brunch and Telluride. That's really the beauty of the live blog, I think, is we get to include all the little gossip that otherwise would just be texted to each other. So enjoy. And you can follow us all on our own on social media. I'm on Twitter at Katie Rich and Richard.
Rylos.
And David.
David Canfield 97.
David actually tweeting this time of year, which is a rare treat. So please enjoy it.
We got one more week of it. So.
And Rebecca.
Becca M. Ford.
Our editor and producer is Brett Fuchs. And this week's award for the fair warning we give you if you come up and say hello to us at a film festival goes to Rebecca Ford.
Get ready to cry.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.